Today's May 5th, 2015. This is a Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Today is a public hearing on House Bill 5042, the Oregon Water Resources Department. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 5042. And we'll call up Mr. Beiler and Ms. Connolly.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the director at the Oregon Water Resources Department. At my side here is Kathy Connolly, the DAS analyst, who is tracking our budget. Very pleased to be here this morning to talk about the proposed budget for the 2015-2017 biennium for the Oregon Water Resources Department, the Phase 2 discussion. Wanted to, before I go into the materials, just wanted to reintroduce you to a number of our staff who are here who can help answer questions that you might have this morning. Our Deputy Director, Tom Paul, our Field Services Administrator, Doug Woodcock, our Technical Services Administrator, Brenda Bateman, our Administrative Services Division Leader, Tracy Loudon, Dwight, yeah, I wanted to make sure he was here. Dwight French, who leads our Water Rights Services Division, and a face you've probably seen around the halls a fair bit this session, Raquel Rancier, who is our Senior Policy Coordinator and is on point for us on our legislative issues. So with our presentation today, we've got, we're going to walk you through our option packages another time. Want to see if you have any questions that we can help with. We also have a key performance measure that we wanted to loop back with you on. So I'll just dive in. If I'm going to start with the key performance measure. As you may recall, we have 14 key performance measures, and key performance measure number 8 was one that that we had some discussion and interest in maybe looking at revising the target. This is a performance measure that involves the implementation of a program that began in the year 2000, where we began to look at implementing and requiring measuring devices on significant water uses in watersheds that were deemed important, and those important watersheds were identified in concert with, in consultation with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And really the underlying desire here was for us to get a better handle on the management of water in these important watersheds and these more significant points of diversion, larger water diversions, either based on a certain amount of water or relative to the stream, size of the stream that those water diversions were on, became the area of focus for us, where we were kind of majoring on the majors in those areas. So we've been working with folks and water users in those areas for some time now. In 2009, the legislature added a key performance measure around this this particular program, and added to it a target of 175 new measuring devices to be implemented each year. And as you can see through the slide here, the line shows the trajectory for the target, and the bars show what we've been able to achieve over that time period. And the trajectories are not on the same on the same plane. We have not been able to meet this target at all over this period of time, which led to the conversation and interest in is there a better, more reasonable target that that we could be aiming for that we might have some chance of meeting over time. So again, 175 per year is not something we've been able to attain. What we suggest and recommend is a target of 75 per year, and it's based on looking at the period of time that we've had this performance measure, and we've ranged over that period of time of a year where we had about 50 measuring devices implemented in a 1 year period to a period where, or a year where we had over 100, and so that's kind of the bookend range that we've had. And so our recommendation is that we look at something in between there as a good test and a good goal for us to shoot at in each given year. So 75 is the magic number that we've come up with. We think it's a reasonable target. We think that there'll be times when we'll be able to attain it and other times when we may struggle to. But nevertheless, that's, I think, what targets are for generally. There was some discussion previously about assigning a percentage of the total as a way to move forward on this particular program area. And our recommendation is that we not approach it that from that standpoint. And in part, it's because of the universe of significant points of diversion that we're that we are looking at here. The those water rights aren't used every year, and in some instances, a water right holder may not use the water right for a period of a couple of years, and then start using the water again. And what that does is it creates kind of a the total number of uses can vacillate over time. So if we attach a percentage of a goal, a target, I think our concern is that we would see a trajectory that would be pretty bumpy. From our standpoint, we think that we've gone after a solid number in terms of 175 in the past. If we just ratchet that down to what we think is a more realistic number, we will make progress on the universe of significant points of diversion. It's just a matter of time before we get to that ultimate goal. So I'll pause there and see if there are any questions on that.
Please continue.
All right. If I may, I want to spend just a little bit of time reorienting you around context that's important to understand our option packages. And I won't belabor this too much, but just as a reminder, we are the Water Quantity Agency. We are the agency that manages the distribution of the use of water around the state. And as you may recall, we're an agency that's been around for quite a long time. The agency was created by the legislature in 1905. The Water Code was established in 1909. But water uses predate that by a significant margin. We have water rights around the state that have priority dates from the mid-19th century. So there's and we're based on a very simple system that is indicative and used throughout the arid West of what's called the prior appropriation doctrine. And it simply is a system by which the more senior water right holders have greater certainty in times of water shortage that they will be able to use water in any given year. And this slide here, you may recall, gives an example of the ability for a senior user in a water short year to be able to make a call, that is, contact the water master, our staff in the field. When there's not enough water, the water master, after receiving a call, can contact those junior water right holders, require that they discontinue their use in order for the senior water right holder to be able to achieve their full amount of water under their water right. So it's a very basic system, it rewards those senior users, so I'll leave it at that. 2009, the legislature directed the department to engage in develop a statewide strategy for water. In 2012, our Water Resources Commission adopted the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. It was an effort, a multi-year effort, that involved many stakeholders around the state, many town hall meetings. We had strong partnership from the Department of Agriculture, Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Environmental Quality. The product is significant for us, and it's timely for us in terms of the issues that we face today around the use of water and our ability to be able to meet needs for water users both today and into the future. The Integrated Water Resources Strategy itself has over 40 recommendations for actions. It is the compass and the blueprint by which we prioritize our work from a staff standpoint and from a commission standpoint. And it's based on four fundamental areas. One, we need to understand the resources, the status of the resources, both surface water and groundwater, that our communities have available to them. Secondly, we need to understand the needs within those communities. What are the needs of municipalities? What are the needs of the ag community? What are the needs of the environment with respect to water? Thirdly, we need to understand what are some of the key drivers that are influencing our decisions. Drought has been an area that has had a major impact over, especially in recent years. Climate change concerns are increasing in terms of how that may be affecting the hydrograph and the availability of water and the timing of water as it moves through basins. That could be changing. Understanding those areas and then using that information to be able to identify ideas and project ideas around solutions, developing solutions to meet needs for communities around the state. Those are the core principles that the Integrated Water Resources Strategy lines out for us. Those are underlying principles that informed our option packages that we'll talk about in a few minutes with you today. In terms of our budget requests, I can describe the framework for our budget requests around three areas. One is very much tied to the Integrated Water Resources Strategy and the goals around that in terms of working collaboratively with communities to help them develop water supply solutions for their future, both in-stream and out-of-stream. We also have option package requests that are oriented at strengthening our core functions, the distribution of water, understanding the resource, working, and then thirdly, working with communities to resolve what are often very complex challenges around the distribution of water in those areas. So update on the status of the resource. These two slides show water availability, and the slide on the left shows water availability on surface water in August. And the key point here is that if you see bluer colors, that means there's water available at that time of year for appropriation, again, in August, of surface water. And what you see on the left there is that there's not much water available during that time of year. And this is indicative of what we're seeing around the state, that for surface water sources, in the times of year when people typically need water the most, the spring, summer, and early fall, water is simply not available for new uses. And in part, that's to protect the existing users who are using water in those areas around the state. What that means is that water, the so-called easy water, being able to cost-effectively obtain water out of a stream, apply it to land during these times of year, is not an option in most parts of the state. So the slide, or the on the right-hand side, you'll see a map that shows water availability for storage in January. And you'll see there's a lot more blue area in that. And the point here is that as the easy water, the surface water sources in the summertime are increasingly unavailable, folks are going to need to look at other ways to meet their needs. Storage is an area where there is water availability. There are complications associated with that, as you are probably well aware, with respect to the costs associated with building storage and maintaining and operating storage facilities, as well as the myriad challenges of moving through regulatory processes associated with being able to site and build these types of facilities. Nevertheless, this is an important part of what's on our radar screen, as well as the radar screen of many of the folks that we work with around the state, being able to navigate through successfully through these types of processes to be able to attain water supply through storage is going to be an increasing interest and need for us. If folks aren't going to look at storage, they're going to look at groundwater. And we're seeing a dramatic increase of applications for permits to appropriate groundwater. And the point that I'd like to make here is that in this particular map, you'll see areas that are broader geographies that are yellow. You'll see a number of circles that are a different color. If those colored circles are red, pink or yellow, that means we're seeing aquifer declines. The yellow geography means those are areas where we have concerns about the vulnerability, the long-term vulnerability of the groundwater resource. This is important also for communities around the state that we have a good understanding of the how much water is available, how sustainable is the resource in terms of groundwater for the existing users that are using, that have wells that are using it, whether they're domestic or irrigation rights or municipal rights, but also how much is available and can be used sustainably for new uses. This is an area of increasing concern for us. It's an area that's important because many of the new needs that communities see, especially on the east side of the state, are pursued through groundwater resources. Just real briefly here, what happens when we overtap the aquifers? And we do have some administrative tools available to us to be able to address challenges when we find that the aquifer levels are not being replenished on a yearly basis. And you'll see there are a number of areas that are colored here on the map. The darker colors are the more severe administrative restrictions. Senator Hansel will is familiar with a couple of areas up in his district where we have in the past declared critical groundwater areas. The declines there were so significant that not only did we put in administrative restrictions that would not allow new uses to occur in that area, but we actually ratcheted back the existing uses in order to allow that system to repair itself and start to restore itself. We don't want these types of situations to happen to any community. It's very disruptive. It can be a very big detriment, as you can imagine, to any community to face that kind of situation. We want to work closely with communities to track the resource, be able to understand what's out there, and get ahead of problems before they become dire. The other areas that we have, you'll note in the Willamette Basin, we have a number of areas where we have concerns about the groundwater levels. We're working with those communities in those areas to stabilize those resources and make sure that they're sustainable over time. You may remember these slides from the past. I spent a lot of time with these, this map shows the amount of precipitation that it has occurred this water year. A water year occurs from October to October every year. And when I was last here presenting to you in our initial budget presentation, I showed you this map, and all the colors were green, which meant that the precipitation averages, percent of normal, was between 90 and 110%. And today we're looking at in the mid-80s, roughly, for most basins of the state, which is not a horrible place to be. We've had probably worse years in terms of precipitation, but I think this does indicate that we have not had a wet spring, which is problematic. It's particularly problematic when you compare the precipitation slide with this slide, which shows the percentage of snowpack compared to the average. And here the numbers are very dire. You heard about this from me at our last meeting, but you may have also seen some of this through the news media. We have a very tough year ahead of us with respect to water and drought. And a large driver of that has been the higher temperatures that we've experienced this year, which have decimated snowpack levels around the state. So you'll see that it's virtually non-existent in most areas of the state. Well, what does that mean? I can tell you that there are a number of folks out there who consider this to be the new normal, that this plays into some of the predictions around climate change, that we're going to see higher temperatures over time, and that will translate into, despite how much precipitation we get, it will translate into less snowpack, which means a changed hydrograph. Snowpack for many water right holders means storage. That's water that's retained up in the mountains and comes down later in the year through stream flows and enables people to meet their water rights. That's been the case for decades for many senior water right holders. And if we find, I'm not the right person to ask whether this is the new normal or not, but if we find that this does happen more frequently, It's going to create significant challenges for a number of water right users around the state who have relied historically on snowpack melt to satisfy their water right and their late season flows in the streams that those snowpacks melt into. This is another slide. It's an update from a slide that that I shared with you at our initial budget meeting. And this is produced, there's a couple federal agencies and a drought council organization, national organization, that developed this around the United States. This just shows the drought conditions, the dryness, essentially, throughout Oregon. And what I would point out to you is that when I met with you and presented to you previously, some weeks ago, the left-hand side of the state, the Oregon coast, was white, which meant the conditions were okay. And so what we're seeing is the darker the colors, the more dry the conditions, and we're seeing those start to move into a greater part of the state. It's, I think, somewhat natural trajectory given where we are in the season that we're at, but it's of significant concern for us at this point in the game. As you're probably well aware, we currently have 7 counties that have requested and received emergency drought declarations by the governor. That sets into motion a number of specific activities and tools and potential to receive federal funding for water users in those communities. So far, we're seeing primarily the southeast part of the state, but we are expecting maybe from as many as 3 to 7 more counties requesting drought declarations at the next drought council meeting, which will occur on May 14th. It's a significant situation for folks around the state, and we're doing what we can on our end to review drought applications for temporary transfers, for drought or drought permits. We will continue to try to serve those communities to the best of our ability. I do want to point out that this scenario is important to us, and I want to loop it back to the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, because the strategy really sets in motion, I believe, a framework for us to address these situations. We're not always going to be in drought cycles, but we, regardless of the conditions that we might have this year, we do know that the water resources around the state, the surface water resources, have been fully appropriated in most basins of the state. And for any community to grow, to develop, and to meet its future needs, we're going to need to find ways to help those communities navigate through a complex body of law and complex physical and engineering issues in order for them to be able to develop solutions for themselves. So our approach is to really focus on helping these communities plan, to test out their ideas, and to get projects on the ground to help move those ideas forward. And with that, I'm going to move to our option packages. And again, what we have here as part of this package is a team that we would like to be able to help communities with technical guidance, technical advice, to navigate through what I think are very complex and challenging issues around the state in terms of developing water supply. These positions are important to us for those purposes, and I'll walk you through them. We are seeking, well, first of all, I'd like to say that the second to the last bullet, if you can just in your mind's eye cross that one out, that was, it's duplicative. There are 6 positions here, not 7, that I want to talk with you about. So I apologize for that that error. But the water supply engineer position is one where we feel that it would be very important for us, for our purposes, and for communities to be able to have the level of expertise available to be able to help guide communities through the engineering issues, whether that means working with folks on evaluating new storage sites, new storage opportunities, or expanding existing storage these are areas where engineering expertise will be important. As you're well aware, part of using water means moving water from one place to another. That requires water infrastructure, and having this position will help us to do two things. One, it will help us to provide a level of advice and technical guidance to communities, especially smaller rural communities around the state or areas where they don't have that capacity internally to be able to handle those types of issues. And secondly, will help us in terms of our own in-house ability to be able to review ideas, to review feasibility studies, to look at project ideas that come our way through our programs. The next bullet there, place-based planning coordinators, there's two positions there in our option package. And what we're looking at here is this is the planning element of our program. And there are many communities around the state who would benefit from going through some planning. And when I talk about planning, what we are focused on is empowering local communities to help develop the vision for their future with respect to water supply. We think that's important for a variety of reasons. One, we think that's where you get the best outcomes. Two, anyone who spends a lot of time around water quantity-related issues will hear someone say at some point that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. And it's a classic phrase. I don't think I've ever been to a water conference where that hasn't been used. And the sad reality is that there's a lot to back that up. There's a long history of fighting over water, whether it's neighbor to neighbor or whether it's litigation between different interests. There's a long history there. And part of what we would like to be able to do is help communities work collaboratively, bringing people together on the front end as they plan their future, as they look at the resources that might be available to them, as they develop ideas on what their needs will be in the future, and as they come up with ideas. Our feeling is that these communities will be more successful in the long run if they do that in a collaborative manner, working with a variety of interests in those communities. These two positions would be designed to help provide, act as a partner, and to provide resources for those communities that choose to go down this path. We certainly would not require any community to do this, but we would heartily recommend that if they don't already have a strategy and plan in place, we would recommend this approach. These staff resources would be available through these two positions to sit in on these meetings, to help guide the group discussions, provide technical advice to those discussions over time. The next position, project manager position, is really oriented around helping communities who have project ideas move them from the conception level to completion. Our experience has been that there's a wide range of different types of projects that can happen. Some of them are incredibly complex. They take years to plan, develop, and move forward on. Our ability to be able to provide access of staff expertise a steady partner to be able to work with those communities who are working on these types of projects is what this position is really designed to do. We think that having that resource will help many communities better anticipate the challenges associated with these types of projects and put them in a position to be more successful in the long run. Again, we want to be a partner. We want to be helpful to these communities. And these resources are designed to help give us the capacity to be able to do these types of activities rather than just kind of our more traditional core functions of distributing water and issuing and considering water right applications. Similar to the project manager, the next bullet here is a water supply technical coordinator position, serving many similar functions, but maybe at a more technical level, looking at water availability, the hydrograph, helping folks with permitting issues. That position would do similar activities, but at a slightly different elevation. Then again, I'm going to skip the second to the last because that's we already covered that with the project manager position. And the last on this list is a finance manager position. The idea here is that all of these projects cost money, as you know. We're not in the same era that we were in the mid-20th century, where the federal government was making very strong investments in water supply development, developing huge projects around the western United States. If communities around Oregon want to move forward on addressing their water supply needs, and they need resources to do that, they're going to have to be creative. They're going to have to be innovative in doing so. As you'll hear in just a minute, we have ideas in terms of capitalizing state so that the state can be a partner in this. But it's going to take more than that, we think, to be successful. This position, the finance position, is designed to be a resource to help help the state and help our partners understand the complexities around financing these types of projects, and to be able to help guide folks who have these project ideas and to be successful. I think increasingly we're going to be seeing situations where we're going to be looking at matching state, federal, and private sources of funding to be able to make these types of projects happen. This is not territory that is easily tread by folks who are not accustomed to these issue areas. This position would give us capacity that we don't currently have and would be an asset for us to be able to offer to communities to help them navigate through those types of issues.
Mr. Chair. Yes, sir.
You know, as you know, I'm very supportive of, you know, the state's investment in this area and finding partnerships, you know, with local governments and business and federal. What if we're not able to get there? I mean, to what extent do these positions, are they dependent on a significant state investment in infrastructure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Denbrough, the way we view these positions is that these positions are needed regardless of whether the state brings resources forward, and I'll talk about those resources in just a minute. But we know that there are communities around the state today. They're not waiting for the state to bring money forward for these kinds of investments. They're acting now to try to develop their solutions for the future. Would they prefer to have state resources? Yes, absolutely. But it's not a given, and I think folks recognize that. So from our standpoint, this list of positions, we see the need for these positions as a resource for the state, regardless of whether we're able to capitalize whether the state will have loans and grants available for communities. These positions will add value to the communities who are trying to wrestle with their water challenges.
And maybe you might want to explain how Senate Bill 266 will work with Prop 115 and 105.
I'm going to get to that with the next slide.
Okay,
so if there aren't any more questions, I thought I'd give you a busy slide just to keep your morning interesting here. I apologize for this, but let me step you through this a little bit. This is the funding element of our budget. It's an important one, and those positions I just walked you through are, you know, have a tangible connection to these funds. But this is more specific to the funding itself and the positions that we have that would be administering those dollars. Again, at the bottom, you'll see the kind of the arc that the framework that we're looking at in terms of working with communities, the planning, the feasibility, and the project financing are the core elements and the key elements of this funding, and that those positions that I've talked about will help with. With respect to the funding itself, we have a combination, and I'll point you to the summary of funding box there on the right-hand side. We have a combination of lottery funds, general obligation, lottery bond dollars, excuse me, general obligation bond dollars, and general fund dollars for grant specialist, grant administrative staffing tied into this element of our option packages. And so those are the total numbers. Now I'm going to step you through the elements of it. There's an of those total funds, we have carved out $750,000 for place-based planning. Those two positions I mentioned earlier involving place-based planning would help add staff resources to this funding resource. Our desire is, and getting to Chair Rayfield's point, is to be able to offer grants to communities for these resources. And that, then I'd point you to the top right-hand corner of the slide. Senate Bill 266 is a bill that is been sent to Ways and Means, and it would provide the authority for the department to be able to offer grants for this place-based planning purposes. The second element of the funding would be to add an additional $2 million of lottery bonds to a base budget of $750,000 that we have for feasibility grants. This is a program that we've had on the books since 2008. We have had a lot of active use around the program. Typically, we see more demand than we have funds for. We would like to be able to add additional resources to that fund. Again, the idea around this, or the purpose of these funds, are to help communities do the necessary studies to move a project idea into a viable project that could be funded and with on-the-ground capital dollars. The third element of this is the project financing and project implementation, and it's a combination of the lottery bond dollars and the general obligation bond dollars. You'll see the $17.25 million of lottery bonds and then $30 million of general obligation bonds. There are several different areas where those, at least in the governor's recommended budget, where those dollars would reside. One is in Senate Bill 839, which is a legislation that was passed in 2013, which establishes grants and loans, a program that we'll have up and running at the beginning of the new biennium. We also have a water supply fund, which has been a kind of a more flexible vehicle that we'll need to talk with you about if you have interest in that vessel, to make sure that we have the right sideboards around it and right direction in terms of how those funds would be used. And then thirdly, the general obligation bonds would recapitalize a fund that's been available since the 1970s. This is a constitutionally created fund that allows residents of Oregon, small municipalities, to do a wide array of projects. This program hasn't been in use for some time now. The idea here is to use all available programs to be able to provide resources to folks around the state. With these programs, we have in two different packages 1.75 FTE that we would like to be able to bring into play to be able to help administer these programs, the loans, the grants, the work in terms of soliciting the applications, the review, and then managing those awards as they move forward.
Before you move on, I just had a couple of questions, because this is something I'm just trying to understand, and I think I've got an overview of. But there's three different funds, and we're shoving money into different funds. And just from a practical standpoint, you say, well, why not just put the money in one fund as opposed to three? So what, and you touched on it very briefly, but what are the purposes and or advantages, scope of the various funds, and why are we using specific funds to allocate? I mean, we're putting geo bonds in one fund, lottery bonds in another, and so I just kind of want to dive into that a little more.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Quite honestly, I think part of the reasoning of the way our budget was built was to preserve options, not knowing exactly, you know, we don't have, we ourselves aren't sure exactly which are the best vehicles, and I think that's certainly a subject for discussion, so I'll put that out there. I think by developing the budget the way we have, what we do is stimulate that conversation and create opportunity. In terms of the different funding sources, again, we're looking at I may move forward just to see if this helps the conversation. this is a roll-up of all that we have, and this might be easier for folks to look at as we talk through this. So one element that we're looking to create through Senate Bill 266 is the ability to offer grants for plan or for place-based planning. So that would be one distinct vehicle and one distinct program. And the idea there would be very limited to those purposes.
And what fund does that go through?
That would be.
They all sound the same when I was looking.
And I apologize, it is confusing because the terminology that we have assigned to our different funding vehicles are very similar. Okay, I believe it's the Water Supply Fund.
Okay. And tell me about that. I mean, as we were talking about the three different vehicles, I kind of would like to explore more and learn more. Why do we use the Water Supply Fund specifically for place-based planning?
So the Water Supply Fund, pardon me, I'm looking for my cheat sheet here. The Water Supply Fund is the most flexible of the funds that we have out there. And so, one reason that we would put some dollars there is just to preserve flexibility. And so Senate Bill 266, the place-based planning, we don't have that authority on the books yet. By putting those funds for those purposes in the Water Supply Fund, we preserve the flexibility to be able to use those funds for those purposes.
And when you say flexibility, what does that mean? For you guys.
So, for example, if we were to put the $750,000 for place-based planning in the Senate Bill 839 Water Supply Development Fund, those funds would not be eligible under that program with the statutory sideboards on that program.
Okay. So are there any sideboards on the Water Supply Fund?
There are no statutory sideboards on that fund. The way that's been used in the past is that we've had direction as part of the budget process how those dollars would be used.
Okay, that's helpful. And when was that fund developed?
Right. 2009 is what I'm hearing from the gallery.
And I appreciate you bearing with me. I just really want to understand it.
Good questions, and it's not easy to understand at first glance, or even second glance, for that matter, Mr. Chair.
This is my third glance.
So. did we cover your question enough?
Yeah, no, that was fantastic.
Okay. So I won't belabor this slide too much, other than just to say this is a roll-up of what I've been talking about in terms of the three core areas of investment, both in terms of staff resources and funding, is around planning, feasibility, and projects. The underlying that arc is the funding piece that we just talked about, those different elements of grants and loans. And then at the bottom of the slide is the technical assistance, those staff resources that we would bring to bear to help communities. So just a roll up there, and I won't belabor that unless there are questions.
Yeah, I guess the other two portions was the 17.25. It looks like it goes to the Water Supply Development Loans, or I think that's the Water Supply Development Account.
So that's not completely accurate. To be more accurate, that 17.25 is split between two accounts.
Okay.
$11 million in the recommended budget that would be housed in the Water Supply Fund,
okay,
which would need some further clarification from the legislature in terms of how those dollars would be used.
Okay.
And the 6.25 of lottery bonds is housed in the Senate Bill 839 fund.
And what's the title of that account?
It's the Water Supply Development Fund.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, versus the Water Supply Development Loan Fund, which is the constitutional fund that we have. So we may want to think about how we can better describe these funds and so they're more easily distinguishable.
Very good. And then the $30 million on Package 120, where does that go?
Mr. Chair, those are general obligation bond dollars that would be placed in the constitutional fund. This is the Water Supply Development Loan Fund. And that program, again, has been on the books since 1977 and is loan only, general obligation bond only. And whereas the Senate Bill 839 program can offer loans and grants.
And does the Water Supply Development Fund, does that have sideboards on it as well, or what's its flexibility?
Yes, the Senate, the Water Supply, did you say the loan fund or the?
So we've got the Water Supply Fund, and we've got the Water Supply Development Fund, and then the Package 120 is the water.
It's the Water Supply Development Loan Fund, I believe.
Fund,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Chair, okay. we practice a lot of nuance here. I apologize.
So the Water Supply Development Loan Fund, now that we're on the same page, what type of sideboards does that have?
Mr. Chair, that program is in the Constitution. It's also in statute, and we have rules associated with that. It's available to any Oregon resident. It's available to municipalities of 30,000, a population of 30,000 or less. And it can be used for a wide variety of projects, including agriculture, irrigation types of projects, community water supply, fish and wildlife, watershed health. There's a very wide array. There is a limitation in the program to the standpoint that it reserves 50%, at least 50% of the funding at any given time that it's used. Must be dedicated to irrigation or drainage types of projects.
And so, and I know we've kind of chatted a little bit about this, but at the time I don't think I really understood the distinct three funds. And so the criteria for, you know, selecting projects through each one of these, each one of these various funds, how does that get done? Is it different? Depending on what fund you're using, obviously outside of the sideboards.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. The Water Supply Development Loan Fund, Package 120, has its own criteria. It has its own rules, and we would abide by those rules in any issuance of loans that we would do through that program. Similarly, the Water Supply Development Fund, if I got that right, is the Senate Bill 839 program. We're just in the process of doing rulemaking on that. The rules are out for public review right now and public comment, and we're hoping to get those in front of our commission at its June meeting. So that that program is just getting started. It also has its own set of rules and guidance that we would use and criteria that we would use that would conform with the statute in Senate Bill 839 from 2013, as well as the rules that we are promulgating currently. The Water Supply Fund is the one where we would need some there is no program associated with that. There are no rules associated with that. So that's where some further conversation would be needed if we are to use that vehicle. We would need some guidance and direction from the legislature.
And then with the loan program, that is the Water Supply Development Loan Fund. And obviously we've sat here, and I think I kind of briefly mentioned this in one of our other meetings, that, you know, there's various loan programs where we've seen defaults. Will this program be administered solely through the Water Resource Department, or would, and I know that we've got folks, you know, in the policy option packages for this, how do you prevent winding up in defaults, I guess, when you're managing that? I don't know if this is traditionally your bag of tricks.
Yeah. So. Mr. Chair, that's very much an interest to avoid those types of situations. To be clear, this program has a spotty history. As I mentioned, it was put into place in 1977 by the voters of Oregon. At that time, the program funded a number of projects for a number of years into the 1980s. That weren't well devised. They were loans to individuals and entities that in retrospect probably weren't good investments on the state's part. a percentage of the loan or the projects that we offered loans on at that time defaulted, mm-hmm. which required at that time the agency to go back to the legislature and seek general fund to be able to restore those funds. This is a program that is designed around having the loan recipients pay back the funds. And so since that time, there have been we've updated the program in past based on what we learned through that. We've worked with the state treasurer's office. There, I think, has been a significant learning curve in terms of adding appropriate controls so that if we were to manage this program moving forward, we would make sure that we're making loans to entities that have the ability to be able to repay.
Well, I appreciate you bearing with me for all this. It was very informative. So, are there any other questions after my long-winded questions? No. Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate your interest. So this is the last element of our budget that I wanted to walk you through. And we're kind of shifting away from the water supply interest to what we consider to be equally important from our standpoint in terms of strengthening our core functions to be able to serve the public and to address key challenges in communities around the state. There are five positions here, and I'll just walk you through them briefly. Several of these involve a basin that that you're probably well aware of that has had some water issues over quite a long time, and that's the Klamath Basin. This is an area where the adjudication of pre-1909 claims to water use has been ongoing for 40 years. And we're now at a point where we've made administrative findings, and we're just in recent years, for the first time, actually regulating use of water in that basin according to the priority dates for the water. This is an area that's had significant challenges. They've had droughts declared 15 out of the last 23 years. They've had challenges with water use related to the Endangered Species Act for a number of different species. They have water quality issues. There are challenges with respect to a federal project there and Upper Basin ranching community. There are tribal interests, you name it, in terms of complications around water use. The Klamath Basin has it all. The good news around the Klamath is that there have been significant efforts underway to try to resolve those and put that basin and those communities on a path forward that will allow for a balancing of those uses. This has been an effort that the governor's office and a number of our staff have been, as well as a myriad of other agencies and interests, have been working hard on for a number of years. Some of the key components to that are the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and the hydroelectric settlement that were put together, I think, in 2010. And then more recently, the Upper Basin Comprehensive Agreement, which captured some of the interests that weren't included in the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. These agreements are significant. They set a path forward, as I mentioned, for these communities. And in order for us to be able to implement these programs, we need to make sure that we have the resources to be able to work in those communities successfully. So that leads me to the Klamath coordinator position. Currently, we're sending a number of our staff, deputy level and administrator level staff, down to the Klamath to work on implementation of these agreements on a regular basis, sometimes two or three times a month, a couple days a whack. We're sending folks down there. Now, that's good. We need to have that presence. We need to have that level of focus. But it does take away from the responsibilities that those folks have for a wide array of other tasks that they have on their plates. What we'd like to be able to do is have this Klamath coordinator position, which is a high-level position that would be able to help serve as a full-time liaison coordinator with the community down there, representing the state, helping the governor's office as well as the Water Resources Department carry forward on the terms and the obligations set out in these important agreements. So that position would give us very significant capacity to help with those efforts as we move forward. Similarly, the Water Rights Special Projects position, this is a bit of a hybrid position covering a couple of areas for us that are important. One related to the Klamath. Part of the obligations and commitments made under the agreements in the Klamath Basin involve the redistribution of about 30,000 acre feet of water for watershed health and in-stream protection purposes. In order to be able to do that, we're going to need to process a series of in-stream leases and transfers to be able to make that happen. This position would provide us some horsepower to be able to carry that out, knowing that there's a growing need for those that and demand in that area for those types of transactions. This position also would help us with some of the backlog issues that we have currently in our programs relating to, in particular, to water rights certificates and completing the claims of beneficial use for those rights. This position would be very helpful in helping us with those types of transactions statewide. Third position is a hydrotech position. This is a position that will help us understand the resource in the Klamath Basin. This is an area that, as I mentioned earlier, is just beginning to understand what it means to be a regulated community in terms of the distribution of water. Most areas, all areas of the state, frankly, have long experience working with our water masters around the state in terms of the distribution of water in times of shortage. For the Klamath, it's a newer area. In addition, because of the high stakes of and challenges that that basin's been through, having a refined understanding of surface water and groundwater in that basin is going to be critical for us to be able to successfully manage that basin and keep the stakeholders pointed forward in a positive manner. This position will help us. We have about over 10 stream gauges that we're currently managing in the basin that we have to bring staff from other parts of the state to be able to manage the data, to maintain those gauges. We're looking, based on the terms of the agreements, to increase the number of stream gauges by another 13 to 15 around that basin. And our ability to be able to have staff resources in the basin managing those important data sets and the equipment that help us collect that are going to be extremely important. I'll move on to the last two positions. Monitoring coordinator position is an area of interest for us. We are, as you know, one of many natural resources agencies that serve the state on a variety of different issues. And as you well know, water touches on a lot of the other interests and other natural resources areas. We have, I'm very proud to say that we have a history as a group of state agencies of working collaboratively and working together to try to be strategic and efficient and smart in how we carry out our functions. This position would give us some additional muscle in terms of being able to coordinate and work with on enterprise level efforts with other agencies, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Agriculture, for example, to make sure that our data is dovetailing and being used successfully with the data of other agencies. So one area of focus for this position would be the interagency coordination, both state, federal, also working with our local partners. Another function of this position is to help us be more strategic in terms of how we approach our data sets, prioritizing areas, making sure that we identify and address any gaps in data that are important to us. This position would give us ability to be able to carry out those functions. And lastly, this position would be a point of contact with local governments, soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, other groups who have an interest in water resources and who may be monitoring and measuring the resource to make sure that those entities are using appropriate protocols and standards so that the data they're collecting can be is useful for us all. And lastly, regional solutions coordinator position. I'm sure you're all familiar with the regional solutions program and its purpose of bringing communities together at local geographies to address economic development, regulatory issues, other challenges that those communities face. It's a great model, and we've been involved in those in the past where they interface with water. This position would give us additional capacity to be able to work with those regional solutions groups around the state. It would allow us to currently our involvement involves pulling staff away from their existing responsibilities for us to be able to engage with these regional solutions groups. This position would allow us to have a full-time position who would be able to engage with these groups around the state, especially those areas where they have issues that involve water supply, water rights-related issues. Our sense is that those types of issues are going to come up more and more, especially in the dry side of the state, and this would allow us to have the ability to be able to participate fully in those discussions.
Senator Nimbro.
Yeah, thanks. Tom, are these all general fund positions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nimbro, thank you for that question. All the positions I've talked about are general fund positions.
On those you've talked about?
All of the positions okay. In our budget are general fund. Okay. Mr. Chair, that covers what I've prepared for you today, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions or talk about any other items that are of interest.
Does anybody have any more questions? Yes, Senator Nimbro.
I have a question about the presentation. So has anything changed since you came to us a couple of months ago or whenever it was that you did the initial agency presentation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nimbro, do you mean in terms of the hydrograph and the conditions in this?
No. I'm talking in terms of your budget ask, the budget request. Is it pretty much the same as it was then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nimbro, yes, we've not made any adjustments at this point to our requests.
Are there any questions? Ms. Connolly, is there anything you'd like to add?
Chair Rayfield, no, that's fine.
Senator Nimbro.
I do, since we have some time, I do want to ask about the ODF&W Cascade Locks project, if I can. So one of the things I've been thinking a lot about lately, you know, has been, you know, when it comes to water, when we talk about water quantity, that's water resources. We talk about water quality, that's DEQ. And when it comes to the value of water, you know, sort of the economic value of water, that's raising a whole other set of issues, especially in a time of water scarcity. You know, I don't really foresee a time where Captain Kirk will be able to beam Oregon water down to California, but you know, the question about the value of water is just being raised a lot. And so I'm wondering if we could take the opportunity to talk a little bit about the project that's being considered, you know, where the state's water rights a portion of the state's water rights in Cascade Locks would be transferred to the municipality, which would then sell the water, or it's not clear, provide the water to Nestle. I'm wondering, first of all, how unusual that is that there's that kind of transfer, you know, a permanent transfer of state water to municipalities, which effectively is state to a private entity. So I wonder if you could talk about that and what you foresee as the process. I think we're in the middle of a process now, public comment, right?
Mr. Chair, thanks. Senator Nimbro, thank you for your question. I don't have any information to give you that will give you context about how frequently these types of transfers might occur between the state and other entities. I can tell you that as we find ourselves in this state with fully appropriated systems, that we're going to see more and more entities looking at transfers to be able to move water around to be able to meet needs, evolving needs within communities. So from that standpoint, a transfer, you know, we see transfers come in all the time. From our vantage point, our focus is on our legal analysis, and our focus is on making sure that those transfers only move forward if they avoid injuring other water right holders or don't enlarge the use of the water right. That's the lens that we look through, and we don't judge kind of one way or another the terms of the arrangement between the parties who are proposing the transfer.
Well, to what extent does the benefit to the public have to be taken into consideration in these kinds of transfers, especially here where it's a transfer? It's not private party to private party. It's the state to another party.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembrough, under the law, we don't differentiate who holds the water right. In any of our transfer considerations, it's a water right holder. So it doesn't matter if it's the state or if it's a private individual or the federal government. We have a wide variety of entities that hold state water rights. So we don't distinguish between those or treat any of them differently. We treat them all the same. Under the law, the state law, there is no public interest review for transfers. I would surmise that the policy underlying that is that that analysis was made when the water was first appropriated from whatever river or aquifer it might be involved, and so it's already been taken out of the system, so to speak, as when it received its water right in the first place. Under our system with transfers, we don't take another look at that. We don't ask that question again. The question merely is if you want to change the place of use, the point of diversion, the type of use, you can only do so so long as you don't cause injury to any other user or enlarge your right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just wondering if that's something we need to take another look at, particularly as we're entering a time where water is going to become increasingly valuable. One of the challenges that I find with the, you know, what's being proposed in Cascade Locks is that, you know, the state is essentially trading higher value water for lower value water without getting any direct benefit, you know, financial benefit from it. And in this case it's water that I guess is technically owned by ODF&W, or the water right is held by ODF&W, and at a time that we're being asked to raise fishing licenses and hunting fees, you know, et cetera, should we be essentially just transferring away that benefit? You know, I realize that your agency has to, you know, look at these on a case-by-case basis within the parameters of your authority. But, you know, and this is a question for all of us, really, I think. How do we look at that bigger picture? Because I can only assume that this is going to become more of an issue as time goes on, you know, as there's more and more stress on our water supply. I think someone had mentioned that the transfer could be done, but could be revocable. That is, there could be conditions put on it that would be contingent on whatever is worked out, you know, whatever, you know, final deal is worked out, as it were, with the city of Cascade Locks and Nestle. Is that your understanding or is, you know, the ability of your granting the permit, once the permit is granted, it's irrevocable, the transfer, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, if I'm following your line of questioning here, you know, we do have the ability to be able to place conditions on transfers. I don't know, sitting here today, whether we've placed conditions that kind of would that would have triggers that would reverse the system. But from our standpoint, again, don't want to sound like a broken record here, but we need to be certain around injury, and we can't get to yes on a transfer if we find that there's injury. So if there are other issues associated with the transaction between the entities, there are a number of vehicles that could be used potentially to help address those issues. If it's related to our transaction around transfer, we can certainly add conditions that would help protect those interests. If they're outside of that arrangement, those would probably be better pursued between the parties who are seeking to transfer the water rights.
And just to clarify, it would be, and it's just a legal mechanism that's actually outside. So if I contract with another individual, so I'm going to transfer you my water right, and you and I are going to have a contract. The transfer would actually be outside of the contract between you and myself. If you breached the contract, then I would have provisions in that contract where that water right would revert back to me. And so that would be held in a contract just between you and me and actually not involving the Water Resources Department. But it sounds like you're saying that you actually could put mechanisms in a transfer as well to accomplish some of the same things that you could do in a contract between two parties.
Mr. Chair, I want to be careful about this because I'm not quite sure what the thoughts are.
Yeah, I don't want to put you on a spot here.
Yeah, either. And please do not expose yourself or jump out on a limb. It's not necessary at this time. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Ms. Representative Parrish.
So I don't live in Cascade Locks. That's not my district. But there are states where the private entity, you know, basically has long-term lease on the water. I don't know that we do that here with the bottled water companies that tap into whatever spring or aquifer to bottle. But as I understand this particular issue, I mean, the transfer is really between ODF&W and the city of Cascade Locks. Nestle is a customer of municipal water in this, just like I would be if I had a home, except maybe, or a brewery or some other, you know, company that's going to use water. But as I understand this deal, though, and the transfer in so that Nestle can bottle water, Nestle doesn't have a water right in this. I mean, we're not assigning, the city of Cascade Locks is not assigning a water right to Nestle. That has happened in other states where there's been a water right, sort of a long-term lease water right assigned to a bottler, not necessarily Nestle, but other, I mean, Poland Springs and some of the other companies. But that's not happening here, and that's how I understand what's going on. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, that's my understanding.
Okay. Well, with that, I will go ahead and we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you for your patience for all of our questions. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
I'm sorry.